Turn to the book of the Song of Solomon, chapter number 8. So just left Isaiah, Song of Solomon, chapter number 8. Find Isaiah 1 and turn left, you'll be right there. Song of Solomon, chapter number 8, and verse number 6. Set me a seal upon thy heart as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are as coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be contemned. Well, the Song of Solomon is obviously a song written by Solomon. It's a love song about Solomon and his bride and their love for one another. Sometimes when you read through it, it's from the voice and the perspective of the woman, and sometimes it's from the perspective of the man. So you just have to pay attention who's saying what. But it tells a story about Solomon and this woman, and they go back and forth talking about how much they love one another. It's a beautiful song about a beautiful subject. There's some people who are afraid of being too spiritual and allegorizing things, and they say this is only about marriage, and that's the only thing this is about. And other people are afraid of being too worldly and say, well, this has nothing to do with marriage, and it only has to do with Christ and His church. Well, I believe it's about a husband and a wife, but I also think about, I think if you meditate on marriage from a biblical perspective, it's going to lead you to meditating on Christ and His church. That there are spiritual applications to the Song of Solomon and His church. I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's both. Marriage is a great mystery that's forever linked with Christ and His church. That the very fact that God ordained it is to teach us and to demonstrate the glories of Christ and His church. When Paul gave instructions in Ephesians chapter 5 to wives and husbands, he said, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. So when he's talking about the role of the husband, the role of the wife, he said, this is a great mystery, but this marriage teaches us about Christ and His church. And I think that we have the same thing here, only in reverse. Whereas Paul in the book of Ephesians explicitly talks about the duties of husbands and wives and says, this is a mystery concerning Christ and the church. I think we have nothing but the picture here, and that would shed light on it when we think about Christ and the church. So, but I think it's talking about both. When we get down here to the end, I think it's explicitly talking about the husband and the wife, but we can take that and meditate on Christ and His church. So we can be blessed from both perspectives. See, this is talking about the love, the bride, the text I read is talking about the love the bride has for her husband, and she's longing for him to come home. If you read that whole section there, that's what she's saying. She wants him to return. She loves him so much she can't hardly stand it, and she wants him to come back. And if we just stopped and thought about that, the Lord ascended into heaven. And the bride, His church, serves Him and loves Him. And we love Christ, and our hope is set upon Christ. And the bride of Christ looks for and longs for His return. So we can take truths like this and see how it relates to the church and Jesus Christ. But to understand the picture, you have to understand the literal part of it. That the love between husband and wife. So this morning, as we look at this, I'd like for us to think about both things. The marriage, the love of a husband and wife toward one another in marriage, and also you think about the love that you have for Christ and His church. We should examine ourselves whether or not we love Christ and His church as we ought. And we ought to examine ourselves if we love our spouse as we ought. So that's primarily what we're going to be looking at. The second part is the love of a man and a woman. And this morning I want to look at five sections in that text here and preach on the subject of unquenchable love. So we go through this first part. We're going to look at just the how Solomon is teaching us in this. And how this poem works. Because that's what it is. It's a poem. I read an article this week as a writer, and the name of the article is something like, "Why Your Valentine's Day Poem is Bad." And so he went through and just said why most people write bad poems to their wives. And he said, here's how you can fix it. He said that for one of the reasons one reason men write bad poetry is because they don't understand it. And that's probably right. But, you know, if we're going to read this poem this morning, we need to know how to read it, right? We need to know a little bit about it. And you might be like one of my boys and say, I hate poetry. Why do we have to learn this? Well, there's 200 chapters in the Bible that are poems. Over 200, actually. And that's about 17% of the Bible is poetry. So we ought to at least understand it, right? We ought to at least know how to read it and what the Bible is showing us in these inspired poems. This whole book is a big poem, and we get more out of it if we can understand the techniques of the poetry. So we're going to try to do those things this morning. It's nice when we read it, but it's even better if we can step back and understand sort of the technique that he's putting into it. And we get more out of it if we understand it. So let's look at the first part of it. It says, set me a seal upon my heart as a seal upon my arm. So the first thing I want you to notice here is there's five sections and they all parallel one another. So set me a seal upon my heart. Set me a seal upon my arm. Two lines that have to pretty much say the same thing. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Now, those two lines parallel each other. One talks about death, the other talks about the grave. So, death and the grave, obviously, those two things parallel. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which have the most vehement flame. Those two lines parallel one another. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. So, you're talking about many waters, talking about floods. Synonyms, they parallel. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would be utterly be contemned. Now, those still parallel each other, but just in a different way. So, the first thing we need to know and see in this is these two lines are saying the same thing. They might have a little shade of difference, a little more information. But it's like it's underlining, it's emphasizing that point. Hebrew poetry rhymes the ideas instead of the words. So most people like poems where the words rhyme. Well, in the Bible poetry, the words don't rhyme, the ideas rhyme. So the seal upon thy heart, the seal upon thy arm. The heart and arm are different, and there's a bit of difference there, but the idea of the seal is what's rhyming here. And it's done that way to emphasize that point. So that's the first thing you got to do. The second thing we got to do is we got to know what the words mean. And that, I'm not being smart when I say that, but like that word contempt. Now when I read that, you know what that's saying because you can just, through the context of it, you know what that word means and you give a general idea. But if you look it up and you look up the definition of the word, there's more to it than first meets the eye. So you can get more out of it by knowing exactly what that word means. Same thing with seal. You know what a seal is. But if we look it up and think about those particular words and what a seal was and what it meant and what it does, well then the meaning of the verse just kind of opens up. See, in Bible poetry, every word is very important. And what it does is it gives you a picture of what's in the heart of Solomon. So there's a concept there that, that we can know by knowing the words. So we got to read it literally. So instead of reading the passage and looking for a hidden meaning, the first thing we need to do is go through and get what the words actually mean. And then once we know what they actually mean, once we know the literal thing, then we can start looking for the pictures. Too many times we want to start looking for the hidden meaning or start looking for pictures before we even know what the literal thing, words mean. And the problem that we have reading Hebrew poetry is we're not Hebrews. And we live in 2019, not 600 B.C. So they live in a different time and a different culture. So what was common for them is not too common for us. Having a seal is not a common thing for us. Nobody in here is probably wearing a signet ring. But it was a common thing in that time. So we have to think about it and study it so we can know what he meant. That way we can know what it's saying to us. You can't really understand a metaphor or anything unless you understand the words. So, if I wrote a poem to Crystal and I said, "My love is like a SFTP server." Well, everybody, you might have no idea what that is. And it's something in the technology world. Crystal doesn't know what that is, I would guess. So that means absolutely nothing to her. But if you know what that is, you might be able to say, "Oh, I see what he's saying with that. I see what he means by that server." Or, you guys might know something. There might be a specific coal mining tool. And you could say, you could use a metaphor to that. And I wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about because I don't know what the tool is. Right? So you have to know the words. You have to know what they're talking about. Then you can say, then you can start connecting the dots with the pictures. So that's what we got to do first. We got to figure out what these words mean, what he's talking about. Then we can figure out the picture of it. So what's he talking about? Set me as, or she actually, because it's the bride talking. Set me as a seal upon thy heart, set a seal upon thine arm. So what's she talking about? Well, it's one of those signet rings. It was, or a stamp, sort of. It was a metal or a stone device that had usually a crest or some kind of symbol that a king or somebody would have, and they would seal their documents with that stamp. So we sign our names to everything. Well, they didn't do that in those times. They would stamp it with their signet ring. And it was so unique that it was very hard to counterfeit. So, somebody does a royal proclamation, they want it to count, they'd stamp it with their ring or their signet. And that was their mark. So like in the Westerns, everybody had their brand. They'd brand their cattle. That was their mark. It's very important to have that mark because it was unique to you. And that showed everybody, this is my cattle. And it was precious to them, and it meant a lot to them because it showed ownership and property and authority. So it was a big crime, somebody to mess with somebody else's brand. You see it all through the Bible. It's in the book of Genesis, it's in the book of Revelation, all through it. The signet was very precious to the owner. And they never parted with it, except Pharaoh gave Joseph his signet because he gave him his authority. Same thing with Ahasuerus and Haman. He gave him that so they, sharing his authority. Judah gave up his signet in Genesis 38. You remember that situation with him and Tamar where he didn't have any money to pay her. And she said, "Well, just give me your signet and your bracelet, and that'll be... collateral. Why? Because it's precious. Alright, so let's go back to that text. Set me as a seal upon my heart. Set a seal upon my arm. She didn't say, "Give me your seal." Or seal me with your stamp. She said, "Set me as a seal upon thy heart." What the bride is saying here is, "I want to be that seal. I want to be that signet." And I want to be that. I want to be your seal, that precious thing that is sealed upon your own arm and your own heart. She's asking that she be the seal on his heart, that she be the seal upon his arm. She's not the one being branded here. She wants him to be branded with her. She wants her husband's heart to be branded with her, and her being the signet, her being the seal. She wants to be impressed and branded, so to speak, upon his heart. That he would be captivated by her love, and his heart would belong to no other. His mind would not wander, his thoughts would not go to another, but his heart would be all towards her. And the seal upon the arm would be, well, in Haggai, you don't have to turn there, but in the minor prophets, Haggai 2:23, it says, "In the day, saith the Lord of hosts, will I take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, and make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee." So the Lord says the same thing to Zerubbabel, that the seal upon the arm would be one that is precious, is highly esteemed. I read that sometimes, or a lot of times it'd be a signet ring, but sometimes they'd have it as a necklace. And so where not only they could see it, but everybody could see it. Or like a bracelet. So it would be there, and she wants it there on his arm. So every time he goes throughout the day, he would see it and think of her. This watch was a Father's Day present. And every time I look and see what time it is, I remember that this was a Father's Day present. It's right there all the time. That's what she wants. She wants to be on his heart, on his mind. She wants his attention. That the heart's desire for the bride is for the bridegroom to love her with all of his heart, to honor her, to show her, treat her with dignity and respect. So you have this ring that has power and authority. This is my seal, my stamp, my crest. She wants to be that. She wants him to honor her and bless her and love her and lift her up. To treat her as and see her as valuable and as precious. So men, we can learn from this that we need to honor and love and cherish and have our wives branded, so to speak, upon our hearts and our minds, and treat them with honor and respect and dignity and as a precious commodity in our sight. Two, the next thing we see is as strong as death and cruel as the grave. For love is strong as death and jealousy is cruel as the grave. Well, what's that all about? Well, when you read any poem, you can't just read it fast. Some things you can read faster than others. So if you're reading through the Bible and you get to five chapters of genealogies, you can read that faster than you can the Song of Solomon. Because there's just a list of names. It's still inspired, and I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying you can read that faster than you can something that requires your attention for you to think about and meditate on. And poetry in the Bible, so that would be Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, the Psalms, Job, Proverbs. You have to read those a little bit slower because that's just the way they're designed. You have to think about them. And so you have to read it slow and you have to stop and think and meditate on it. You have to know what the words mean and all the shadings and so forth. So when we read this, at first, I might think, well, that's kind of a weird poem to talk about how much you love somebody, talk about that they're as cruel as the grave. Well, what are we talking about here? To illustrate it, I want to go back to another passage of Song of Solomon in chapter 4, in verse number 1. I used to tease with Crystal with this passage. And you'll see what I mean here. Song of Solomon chapter 4 verse 1. "Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair." So that starts out pretty good for us. "Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats. that appeared from Mount Gilead. Thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn, which came up from the washing whereof every one bears twins, and none is bearing among them. Thy lips are like a thread of scarlet. Thy speech is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. Thy neck is like a tower of David, built for an armory, whereon there hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. So, some of you laugh, some of you think, well, what's wrong with that? That's a pretty good poem. But what we need to do is try to figure out what Solomon was talking about. I used to laugh at it, but, you know, the joke is on me because I didn't understand what Solomon was saying. Because, and, you know, if anybody could get a woman to fall in love with him, it was Solomon. So maybe we should listen to Solomon. Like maybe he knew what he was talking about. Well, these are all metaphors. So let's just go through them real quick and look at them. First, he said, thou hast dove's eyes. Well, what's a dove's eye look like? So we got to stop and think about that. We got to think, well, dove's eyes, they're big and round and black. So she had dark eyes. She had big, round, dark eyes. That's a pretty good metaphor. Well, then the hair is like a flock of goats that appeared from Mount Gilead. Now, what's he talking about there? Well, he didn't say you have hair like a goat, right? That would be bad. But that's not what he said. Well, Solomon wasn't a shepherd. Solomon was a city boy. David was a shepherd. You read Psalm 23, and that's written by a shepherd. He knows what it's like for a shepherd to be out among the sheep. And he knows what it's like to watch over sheep and care for them and take care of them. Well, Solomon grew up, you know, he was a city boy. He didn't know anything about tending sheep. So what's he know about? Well, Mount Gilead was a mountain range. And you can get on the internet and look at it, and it's a long, flat plain east of the Jordan River, and there are hills, it looks like. It just popped up out of nowhere. So you could be down in the valley, and you can see that whole mountain from the valley. It didn't look like there was a lot of trees or anything like that. So you could see from a long distance, you could see the whole of that hill. So there's Solomon walking along, and he looks up on the hill, and there's a herd of goats being herded down off that hill. So what would that look like if you had a herd of goats, black and brown, walking down that hill in unison together? You could just picture them walking down, sort of walking and going together, flowing down that hill. So you can almost imagine what that would look like long hair flowing down off the side of that hill. So if the hill was round, which is what it looks like, and it's green, and you see those goats just sort of going in unison down, long, flowing hair. So it's really a better picture than I might have gave him credit for. It's talking about the flow of her hair. Well, then it gets on to the teeth part that he gets on and says that her teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn, which came up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is bearing among them. Well, what's he saying there? Well, just saying you got a full set of straight, pretty teeth. And that's what he's saying there. There's none bearing. She's not missing any. Now, her teeth are crooked. They're all straight. And so, just naturally straight, white teeth. And that doesn't happen a lot now. I could imagine how many had that back in those days. So he's just praising her beauty. Her temple, like the pomegranates, she's got rosy red cheeks. Well, then we get to the last one. My neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory, whereon hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. All right. So this one, I really had to stop and think a lot about this one, because your neck is like a tower in a fortress with a bunch of soldier shields on it. Well, imagine what that would have been like, though. At first, you know, just kind of laugh, but think about walking through Jerusalem. And there, David's towers were built up in Jerusalem to protect the city. So it had been long and strong, powerful. Nobody, we don't know what it looks like, but I imagine it's probably a good looking tower. Crafted. And if the king is going to have a tower, it's going to be crafted well and so forth. But think about what a sight that would have been to have all of David's mighty men. David had mighty men, and they were famous. They didn't have football players and basketball players. The heroes of that time were the soldiers and the mighty men of valor. And that's whose shields are up around this tower. There's a whole chapter in the Bible just talks about David's mighty men, the heroes of David's army. So these heroes have taken their shields and put them on the outside of the tower. So you're walking through the city of David, the city of Zion, Jerusalem, and there on this big tower up above everything else, shining in the sun, are the shields of all the mighty men and the heroes of Jerusalem. That would have filled you with pride. That would have filled you with joy and honor. It's a big deal whenever somebody wins the Super Bowl. They come back home, they throw them a parade. The whole city comes out and rejoices. And sometimes they'll put statues up for great players and they'll honor them. And it's a thing of civic pride. Well, that's what this tower was. Pride of Jerusalem and David and the king and the throne. It was. So when we think about this tower, it was strong, beautiful, filled him with joy to look at it. So that's what all these metaphors are. They're pictures. So if we know the true thing, then we can say, well, okay, now I see why he said that her hair looked like goats on the mountain. He's talking about that it's long and beautiful and flowing. Well, I can see why he said her teeth look like sheep. She's got them all and they're straight and white and so forth. All right, so let's go back to our text. I want to do that one because that one's a little bit easier. But he says, love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Well, how is death strong? Well, you can't beat death. Christ is the only one that's beat death. And the only way you can beat death is if you're in Christ. Because if you don't know Christ Jesus, you're going to die and you're going to go to hell. If you trust in Christ, you'll die and go and be with Him. Then He'll resurrect your bodies and you'll live with Him through all eternity. The only one stronger than death is Christ. NFL players don't live forever. They're pretty strong, but they don't live forever. Mentally tough men don't live forever. My grandpa Doug is the toughest man I've ever known, probably ever will know. 2 Purple Hearts in World War II. He was dying of cancer and nobody even knew about it because he wouldn't even complain to his doctor that he was hurting. In severe pain. The doctor said he had to have been, but he wouldn't even complain to him about it. And that's what his doctor said. I'm doing this a long time. Never seen anybody tougher in my life. But guess what? He died. He wasn't stronger than death. What's stronger than death? Well, she said she has a love as strong as death. Men, we'll come back to that. Jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Well, how is that honoring her love? Well, how is the grave cruel? How is it cruel? Well, it's cruel because it's never satisfied. The grave will never have enough. That you'll never have enough. You know, the funeral home director is always going to be in business. Because he's always going to have customers. It's never going to be satisfied. I knew a guy down in Georgia, and he went and picked up the bodies from the hospital and so forth and took them to the morgue. Well, he said business was good, but that, you know, that wasn't too good for other people because, you know, they had people dying and so forth. Well, that's what it's talking about. It's cruel. It's unrelenting. There's no way out. Once you're laid in the grave, you're sealed up and you're not getting out. It swallows whole and it consumes. You're not partially buried in the grave. Well, these two are parallel, right? They talk together about this one subject. Death is strong and the grave is cruel. So as death is strong, and so as the grave is cruel, so is her love jealous. Well, she's got a zeal for her man. Her love is unending. There's no way out of her love, so to speak. Her love will never be satisfied. Or she'll never say to her husband, you know what, I've had enough. Her love is like a grave. Her love is like death. It's unrelenting. Never enough. Never satisfied. So she's being serious here. But she's also saying that her love can't be defeated. It can't be stopped. Just like death can't be overcome, her love won't be overcome. And just like the grave can't be satisfied and is cruel in that way, her love won't be satisfied. And just as the grave is cruel, her love is strong and unrelenting. So she's just saying how much she loves him. And nothing will stop her love. Then we get to the coals and the fire. The coals thereof are coals of fire which have a most vehement flame. Passion. Those coals are stoked to a flame. They're tended to. They're watched. What happens if you have a fire and it goes down and now you just got a bunch of burning coals, but you don't tend to it? You don't add wood to it. What's going to happen to those coals of fire? After a while, they're going to go out, aren't they? Well, hers are coals of fire, but have a vehement flame. Those coals are hot, passionate, intense. Her love is strong. But she's also going to tend to that fire. She's going to feed the fire. She's going to watch over the fire of her love for her husband. So this tells us every one of us needs to work on our love and work on our marriage and not take advantage of our marriage, not take advantage of our love, but to watch and to tend over and to stoke and to satisfy of the love of our marriage. Delbert and Loetta know him. I don't know if anybody else does or not. Reggie Moore, he's a pastor in Virginia and then down in Georgia. He was, I think, 90 years old. I went to the hospital to see him. He's had a heart attack. He died a few hours later. He's laying there in the hospital bed. And he said something like, Faye, his wife, was in there. And he scooted over on the bed and started patting it. And said, come over here and lay down with me, pretty lady. And, and she, oh, Reggie, she acted like an embarrassed her. And he looked at me and kind of winked. There he was, 90-some years old, and he was flirting with his wife. And carrying on. That meant a lot to her. But he wasn't just putting on a show. He loved her. And he showed he did. And I saw letters that he wrote to her all through their marriage. And that he truly loved her. And he worked on that. And he showed that even 90 years old, he still continued to show how much he loved his wife. So that's what we need to do. Our whole life is not take these things for granted, but tend to the fire of a marriage. Then we get to this one. Actually, these two actually parallel with the one before. Many waters cannot quench love. So take that fire one step forward. Waters can't quench it, neither can the floods drown it. So let's imagine we go down the creek and we find a bank that goes kind of out in the creek and we start a fire. And we're going to go fishing, but we're having too much fun building that fire, so we just keep adding wood to it. And it goes from a small fire, now it's a bonfire. Now the flame's as high as the ceiling in here, and it's just roaring. Well, something happens upstream, and all of a sudden the water just is coming real fast. It's getting higher and higher. And it starts rising. And we get up on the bank, and now that water's right at the wood. And now that water comes up over top of the fire. So what's going to happen? How long do you think that fire's going to last underwater? Well, it's not going to last underwater, is it? You're not going to look down in the flood water and see that campfire burning underneath it. But she says, the fire of her love is just going to keep on burning. A flood could come through, go over top of that fire, and when the water comes down, that fire is still going to be burning. That's strong, isn't it? It's hot. It's vehement. I read on Popular Mechanics that if you take thermite, which is rust and aluminum powder, and you get it burning with magnesium, it's almost impossible to put out. That that people can do that, and it gets so hot it'll melt through engine blocks, and you can take a fire and drop it down under the water and it'll just keep on burning. If you build a fire in a creek with wood and it goes over, it's going to go out when it goes underwater because of the materials. It doesn't have anything to breathe. But if you have the right materials, it is possible for a fire to keep on burning underwater if you have the right right materials, right fuel, and so forth. So if you have your marriage based on looks, if you have your marriage based on fun, on money, you know what's going to happen when the floodwaters of life come along? It's going to put it out. It's going to put out that fire. But if you have the right materials, like they had, their love had the right material, and even water couldn't put it out. They had the right fuel for that fire. This is a foundation based on something higher than just the physical. And that is the spiritual. So we as Christians have the right materials. If we have our marriage based upon Christ, sickness and death and poverty and all these other things that come along won't put out the fires of love if they are built without foundational materials. And lastly, we have the value of love. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, he'd be utterly contemned, or despised, or scorned, or treated with contempt, looked down on, undervalued, disregarded. If somebody comes and says, well, basically, putting a price on love. If somebody came along and said, I'll trade you $1 million for your marriage, you'd look down on the $1 million. You'd undervalue it. You'd disregard it. So I wouldn't take all the money in the world for my marriage and for my spouse. That's what he's saying. Can't buy me love, right? That's what the Beatles said, and that's what Solomon said. You can't buy love. And it's worth more than all the money in the world. Well, when we think about this, ask yourself, do you have a price in your marriage? The bride here says that she wouldn't take all the money in the world for her marriage. Well, what would you sell for your marriage? What would you sell out for your marriage? Would you give it away for a thrill? Would you sell it for nothing at all? Do you have a price on your marriage? Do you have a price on your spouse that you are willing to give up your marriage and willing for that to hurt if for some other price? Say, I know my marriage needs X, Y, and Z, but that's too much for me to do. That's too much for me to pay in order to bless my spouse or to do that. Well, you set a price on it, haven't you? She said there's no price on her marriage. Don't sell your spouse out for cheap, for something fake, for something that's not even real. Some people sell the joy and the happiness of their marriage for a fictional TV character, because you know that's the standard by which they judge what their spouse ought to be or who they ought to be. So when you look, if you're not married and you're looking for a future spouse, if you are married, look at these things as examples of how we can do this. Now, this is important. Marriage honors God. Hebrews 13:4 tells us the marriage bed is honorable in all things. It honors God to have a good marriage. So when you go out into the world and people look at your marriage and they're kind of envious of that, well, that's a testimony to your love for your spouse, to your Christianity. Well, this is why I love my spouse, and you know that can be a witness. Honor your marriage, honor your spouse, and then you honor God in that. The world doesn't think too much of marriage anymore. The world wants people to either put it off or put it off forever. The world honors money. The world honors promiscuous behavior. The world honors fleshly indulgence. The world honors worldly living. But God honors marriage. God created marriage for our good, And it's important to concentrate and think about marriage as it honors our God. Marriage is good. But just like it's good to read the poems of the Bible, but if you know the meaning behind it, see, it's good to read this passage. If we know the meaning and what it means and what it's saying, it's even better, isn't it? Isn't it better to know more and more about the Bible? Because you enjoy it more and more? Well, marriage is the same way. Marriage is good. But if you know what marriage points to, if you know that it is God that created marriage, God created for our good, but also for His glory, that it honors Him, well, marriage is even better if we know the purpose behind it and what it does. I read this not too long ago. I'm going to close with this. God, He envisioned a land. He called it the land of marriage compared to the land of the world. And He just envisioned people living in marriage in one and living in the flesh in the other. And I'll read this and I'll close. It said, people in the land of marriage do not pursue happiness. They say happiness pursues them. And you have to go out of your way to dodge happiness in marriage, either by selfishness or stubbornness or pride or envy or wrath or lust. You have to avoid happiness in marriage. In the land of marriage, you don't need sureties from the future. What adventure can there be if you always know the odds up front? You can enjoy one another and just living your life together. And in the land of marriage, men and women cherish one another. They delight in one another's strengths, laugh at one another's foibles, bear with one another's weaknesses. Gratitude, that virtue so close together to greatness of heart and the wonder of a child, is the order of day. So I pray that you would take this to heart this morning, and that it'd be a blessing to you to think about and consider the joy that there is in marriage, but also the how it points to our Lord Jesus Christ. May the Lord add the blessing to His Word, and we'll stand and be dismissed in the Word.